Welcome to our podcast. It's funny because it's true. This is Alex McQueen.
This is Timothy Klein.
And we are investigating in this wonderful little podcast, aren't we, Alex? Basically, the nuts and bolts of comedy.
Yes, the DNA.
What makes stuff funny?
And this week, our splendid guest is a national treasure and brilliant comedy performer, Sir Robert Brydon, MBE. Let us start, actually, with your membership of the British Empire. The MBE! The MBE! Where did that come from and why?
I have no idea. That's the interesting thing. When these things happen, unless you were to ask, I suppose, or unless somebody said, because you are proposed for these things, you see.
Why?
Somebody would have proposed me, and then I think someone else has to say, yes, I think that's a good idea. And I'm not curious enough to want to know. I'm just finishing. Let me finish this question.
I know, it is a wonderful sound. I was going to say to the viewer and the listener.
I'm masticating furiously, and I fear that for a percentage of the audience, they'll be living. You know, when we do The Trip and other things like that, where there's eating on screen.
Yeah.
I often see on social media people getting furious, saying he's eating with his mouth open, and when I watch it back, indeed I am, and yet I consider myself to be somebody with impeccable table manners.
Well, of course.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But when faced with the evidence, by which I mean, if you said to me, "Do you eat with your mouth?" I'd say, "I certainly don't," but you do it without realising.
Yeah. Yeah. My ability to breathe through my nose is slightly limited. So I think...
Why? Yeah,
I don't know. It's just, there's a sort of honeycomb construction in the sinuses. I had a CT scan done. And it means...
You love a medical investigation.
I do like it in a minute. We'll come to our medical stuff a little later. But let's just get back to the MBE. You got a letter through the post?
Well, what happened was, I was at a recording of Would I Lie to You? The popular BBC One panel show.
Excellent show.
Yeah. As I helm. And naturally just turning to the cameras. My agent was there,
Maureen
as she
Vincent.
Often is, Maureen Vincent. And there she was in the green room afterwards when we celebrate and David and Lee carry me in their shoulder high, saying, "Rob, you've done it again." And I think they say, and I'm paraphrasing, "Our careers would be nowhere without you." Anyway, they gently lower me and they scurry off together to get me. They make my gin and tonic together.
Oh, lovely.
Lee puts the gin in, and which is ironic because he doesn't drink anymore. David adds the ice and the tonic. Anyway, and Maureen was skulking in the corner and she reached into her handbag and I thought, oh God, she's letting me go. She's sending me a letter.
It's a permanent fear, isn't it?
Oh, no, of course it's not. You genuinely have a terrible fear that your agent is going to let you go?
Never. Not in 1 million years.
I think you do. After you said that.
Crack on.
Anyway, yeah. Crack on. And she said, "Now I've had a letter." And she took out this, from my memory, an official looking letter. And she gave me this letter and there it was. And I was...
Was it still in the envelope?
She'd opened it and read it.
Oh, right.
Okay. Well, they always do that to weed out the nuts. And, you know, you don't want everything being sent to you before it's been... which is why we think that the only post you receive is positive, because your agents weed out all the people who go, "Who's this idiot?" And I read this and go, I was so surprised because I know it was such a shock. Now, of course, there is a question with the whole honours system. You know, some are against it, of course. But I'm afraid I couldn't resist. I mean, if I'm being horribly honest, vanity plays a part. I'm not without vanity. And also, what it meant to my parents, which That's can be very... used as an excuse, but it is true. They were thrilled.
Lit up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's a very good reason for accepting it, actually.
Yeah. Vanity.
No, the parental, the joy that parents...
It is, and, you know, when I had it, it was at Windsor Castle, and it was with the Queen, Queen Elizabeth
II. Oh, right, you were lucky
the
then.
Second.
Yeah, because not everyone gets to get...
No, that's right, you could end up with...
It would be too easy.
Oof, you know, Sophie or, you know, I mean, barely royal, but
you always edit things, don't you?
Oh, you leave that. I don't mind offending the Countess of Wessex. That's all right. I wish her well. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. Anyway, no, I had the Queen. Queen Elizabeth II, and it was lovely, and of course it was it was terrific. And we went for lunch at Heston Blumenthal's pub afterwards. Nice. I mean, could a day
be better?
Be better.
Did Her Majesty know of your work? Did she have any retort for you, any sort of banter?
Did you exchange any words?
How dare you?
Well, because she doesn't say much. I'm meant to let her speak. Because we did a logo for her.
I have to say, and your listeners, of course, will know immediately, but when you say we did a logo, until today, I never met you. And looking at you, I assume that the two of you run some kind of boutique in Carnaby Street for shirts to make up for a lack of personality. But that's not the case, is it?
Now, that takes us to how the blazes we met.
Yeah. Well, hang on a minute. What about the Queen being aware of my work? Because you have had the temerity to suggest she was blissfully unaware of me.
Oh, no, she would be.
But she watched the television.
I could imagine her just saying, well done, or something, and not saying, did like you in
You are forgetting. You are forgetting that in 2012, didn't she celebrate a jubilee in 2012?
Yeah, something like that. Yes, well done.
Diamond. And was there not a huge concert at the front of Buckingham Palace, the one in which Madness played on the roof and Brian May stood on the roof?
Yes. Ed Sheeran,
Stevie Wonder, McCartney.
Yes.
Tom,
didn't
I open the show
as
the host of the show? And didn't I then go on to introduce Sir Tom Jones and Dame Shirley Bassey?
Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
And wasn't Her Royal Highness, Majesty, Greatness sat in said audience? And didn't she get up and crowd surf?
Go, more Rob!
So she was indeed aware.
Great. And did you have a little conversation when the bad...
We did, and it would be wrong of me.
Of course.
Because she was very critical of some of my peers, and I wouldn't like to say... She was there... She let rip. She laid into some of my celebrated comic peers and said...
Steve Coogan. You don't want to say.
I can't say.
But that does bring us then to how on earth how do we know each other? Before we get on to more,
is it via Julia Davis? Did she introduce us?
No,
or were we in something together?
I think it was the Sir Kenneth of the Brand.
Oh, of course, I know. Asked if I yeah. yes,
yeah. And I was just saying earlier, my abiding memory is nearly shattering your leg during one of the fight rehearsals before the show.
Yeah.
I seem to remember pinning you onto the bed.
Yes.
And I remember hearing you...
It wasn't
you
in the script, but desire took over.
It does happen on stage.
I remember you howling.
Yeah.
Thinking, crikey, he's really getting into this. And eventually I realised, you were pleading with me not to snap your leg back over itself.
We were both in a farce.
Yeah, I saw it.
Oh, did you? Right, okay. Right, okay.
Good for
And... yes, and in the there was I was the hapless chap, and Alex was the guy that my wife had left me for, and he's a doctor. And
that's right, yeah.
Comes into this hotel where I am, and da di da di da, and farcical events ensue, and we end up having some kind of back and forth on the bed. Anyway, in the rehearsal, he was doing something and basically trapped my leg. I genuinely thought he's going to snap my what's that bone on the front of the
shin.
The shin, of course. Why didn't I know that? Yeah. The shin is such an exotic bone. We rarely hear of it. And I thought my shin was going to snap.
No, stop.
Yeah, because the shin bone.
Mate, you're really getting into this.
The shin bone. Whenever you become aware of your shin bone, which isn't that often, is it? You don't have all to become aware. Yeah. But you think, oh, that's a brittle affair. You do think, you go, wow, it wouldn't take a lot to break
absolutely
that.
Absolutely right.
But that's how we met. We met on this show and we got on famously. I mean, Alex is such great company. Alex is a one-off. I don't know anybody else like Alex.
Very true.
And he's very splendid. And I've trumpeted his name from every building since then.
God bless you. Now, Let us then turn from one hero to your genuine. Who would you describe as your comedy hero?
Just one person? If I had to narrow it down to one, I would say Barry Humphries.
Yeah.
And I was lucky enough to get to know Barry for the last 14 years of his life, I think. We became friends. We would go to each other's performances. We did a few professional things together. And I was, I mean, lucky enough is not the word. I was, I don't know what the word is. When he was dying in hospital in Sydney, I happened to be in Australia on tour. So I was able to visit him several times. And I consider myself, what is the word for that?
Blessed.
Privileged. Oh. Blessed to have been in that position. So I would say him.
But he was a massive comedy hero of yours.
Huge influence, huge hero. And a lot of the what I do on stage and how I deal with an audience and relate to them was learnt from him.
Ah, this is great. So what do you think were some of the techniques he had? Just and it's whether they're born or he learnt off someone else or he pulled together his own...
Well, I remember saying to him once, I said, you know, there's a lot of stuff I do on stage. I said, that comes directly from watching you. I said, I hope you don't mind. And he said, it's wonderful that somebody is carrying the torch. And I think he meant it because he continued to come and see me perform and we did a few things together. While he was a far greater brain than me and he was far better read, he was far more worldly, he was far more cultured, nonetheless, at some level, I think he felt a kindred spirit, at some level. And we enjoyed each other's company. And
what was it when you looked at him doing his craft? What was it he had that you thought, oh, that's just
it was his utter mastery of commanding the stage. When Edna or Les would interact with the audience, particularly Edna, would interact with the audience and ask them questions, which I do a lot of when I get into conversations. You make characters of these people. I probably learned that from him, although it's naturally what I want to do anyway. And it was the way that he would... seemingly Edna would be very smiling and darling and tell me more about yourself. You know, those glasses, are they prescription? you know, or whatever, or that shit. The line I said earlier, you know, those shirts make up for a lack of personality. Right. You could imagine Edna's a wonderful shirt and of course you don't have to worry about a personality. you could imagine that sort of thing. So it was the accessibility of the humour while remaining very, very sharp. You know, the Dame Edna Experience, which is on television in the 1980s, that was primetime ITV entertainment with one of the greatest comic minds of the age. Mm. Now, that doesn't happen often. And, you know, listen, these primetime ITV shows have got people who are great at what they do, but they're not... they're not the eminent comic minds of their generation.
Right.
And someone said to me the other day, they were talking about somebody, who was it? They were saying, oh yeah, a friend of mine, I won't name him, was talking about another person and said, well, yeah, he's not a generational talent.
Right. I was like, yeah. Whereas Barry Humphries definitely was.
Oh,
I mean,
my
he
God.
Was young.
Yeah. Didn't you think it made it easier for him to be able to roll, to not be him? Because actually he's in a persona, he's created a character, it's about like Steve Coogan's characters. Do you think that helps? Or is he just, would he be as brilliant as himself?
Well, the guise of the character allows you to go off in perhaps more extreme ways than you might as yourself. The characters, all people who are known for characters, they are a combination of aspects of themselves combined, which will then be twisted, perverted, amplified, or suppressed in pursuit of the comic effect. They are also observations of other people. Barry often talked about his mother, and there was a lot of his mother in Dame Edna. So it's a combination of things. And what, you know, you talk about people being themselves on panel shows. Well, often that will be tweaked and amplified as well. Yeah. You know. Say David Mitchell on Would I Lie to You? It's very subtle, but he'll slightly turn up of something and turn down something else.
Right.
But it's very subtle with David.
So if Dame Edna is your principal comedy hero.
Barry Humphries.
Sorry, yes, fair enough. Barry Humphries.
Detail.
Yeah.
Alex, detail.
How did you first physically encounter him? What was your first.
With
collision with him on a personal basis?
Personal? Oh, I can tell you how personal. I don't recall. In terms of witnessing him on the television.
Oh, no, yeah. So more personal.
Or personal. Yeah. Oh, well, I can tell you exactly that. It's a rather splendid story. Perfect for a podcast of this nature.
Great.
I was at home about 14, 15 years ago. And my wife, Claire, who you've had the
pleasure of meeting,
of course. And she still talks about you. She came into the kitchen one day with an envelope, an opened envelope and a letter. And she said, oh, my God. And my rather dramatic nature thought, oh, dear, this is bad news. But she had a smile on her face.
Oh.
But, of course, within the confines of a long marriage, it could have been bad news that she was rather pleased about.
Okay.
And she said, look at this. And she gave me, and it was a letter from Barry to me.
Oh.
Wow, you know, because he was a god.
Yeah.
And it said, dear Rob, it's been brought to my attention some very kind words you said about me in an interview. I want to tell you how this is unframed now on my office wall. I want to tell you how pleasing, da da da. And then he was very nice about me and da-di-da-dum-ba-di-dum-ba-di-bum. And that was that. I thought, well, I was staggered. So I wrote him a letter back. And that was that. And then about 2 weeks later, I was at the Royal Albert Hall. I was hosting a Prince's Trust concert, a sort of fundraising evening. And Dame Edna was in the lineup along with all sorts of other people. And because there were so many acts, not everybody in the dressing room. So what they do is they then tent off some areas with cloths and make little dressing areas. So I had one and I was stood there in the afternoon and all of a sudden I heard a sound over there. Ah! I looked around, there was Barry, looking like Barry Humphries. He had, a double-breasted suit. He had a colourful tie. He had a big coat over it and a fedora and a scarf.
That's like the fedora.
Yes. And he said, a handwritten letter with a fountain pen on Rio paper. And I said, hello. And that was how we met, and I remember it to this day. I said, oh, lovely to meet you. I said, how are you? As he was sitting down. And he said, I'm all right, I suppose, for my age. I said, how old are you? He said, I'm 76. I said, wow. I said, what's that like? And he said, the grave beckons. Well, it didn't beckon for some time because he was 89.
It was over 14 years.
Exactly. But he'd recently had his appendix removed. Okay. And he was, I think it was taking him a while. Yeah. I think it was taking him a while to get over that. We sat down and we must have talked and talked. And you know what? Almost straight away, he was very open with me. Very open. And he was far more vulnerable and sensitive than I would have thought, given the
sharpness.
The sharpness and the acid drops of his humour. Yeah. And it was lovely to discover that. And that was the beginning. And then, you know, he came on, I used to have a chat show on BBC Two, and he came on that as Edna. And then I would go and see him do his shows and go back and say hi. We did a great evening together at the London Palladium, which is called Rob Brydon Probes Barry Humphries, because probes was a word that he would often use as everything. We did that and a few other bits and bobs.
How about if we go further back? There's such a thing. When you did you?
Were you have a little you, moment there where you thought you were about to say something and your mind went blank.
Going to be something. Oh, that was it. I have a question. Oh,
but, okay. You go ahead.
I was only going to pick up. Was like,
my question.
It was nice of you to jump in. You sensed him
I know.
Floundering, didn't you?
And
you
came in. I was.
I thought you had a mini stroke.
My question is, can you remember the first thing that ever made you laugh? Does that actually stick in your mind, or not? And there's no if you don't have
no,
an
not
to the. This,
I mean, I could probably no.
I can rephrase that in a slightly more friendly way. Growing up, what was it that you watched that you started to fall in love and it inspired you into this as a career? I mean,
I would say a much better question. What was the first thing? Who in God's name is going to sit here and go, yes, I do remember the first time I laughed?
Oh, you say that, Matt Lucas, straight off the bat.
So what did he say?
My first joke I wrote when I was three.
Did he?
Yeah, it was terrible.
He said it was terrible as well. Wasn't it?
Well, I'll tell you what, there was a thing I used to say. There was it wouldn't be this, but I used to do that poem, Tarzan in the Jungle Had a Bellyache, Wanted to Go to the Toilet, Too Late. And my dad worked in a showroom in a place called Margam, which is right next to Port Talbot. And it was called, it's not there now, the M4 goes where it once was, over it, a big buildup of earth and it's higher. Margam Abbey Motors, and it was a big showroom, and they had a sort of an office-y bit. And in that office was a microphone, like a tannoy, so that if the person in the office wanted the attention of a salesman, they could press the button and say, could so-and-so, could Dave come to the office? Well, I was in there one day and I pressed the button and I repeated that little verse.
Great, that little verse.
So what was it when you were growing up? What kind of comedians or shows did you find sketch comedy funny, or did you find particular actors funny or writing funny? What was the first draw that inspired you into to where you've become a master?
The two Ronnies.
Two Ronnies.
I love the two Ronnies. And Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, and Larry Grayson. And I liked a lot of the camp comics, so Frankie Howard, Larry Grayson.
Yes, Larry, who's the one who's, oh, you are awful.
That was Dick Emery.
Dick Emery.
I quite like Dick Emery's, you know, I would watch his show, but he didn't grab me. Benny Hill I liked a lot. So Benny Hill, Larry Grayson, Frankie Howard, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore.
Williams.
Oh, yes, yeah. Kenneth Williams, hugely. I adored Kenneth Williams, yes. So those kind of people, Bruce Forsyth I found very funny, Mike Yarwood I found very funny, Michael Crawford as Frank Spencer, would watch that religiously, yeah. Fawlty Towers. Mm. I must admit, I would be, you know, a little cooler if I said, hey, and I was into Monty Python, but I must admit, I was a little bit too young for them. I mean, obviously I caught up with it later, but I was the elder sibling. Now, when my friend Steve Coogan talks about loving Monty Python, he had older siblings, you see. That kind of more advanced stuff would come down to him, but I was the older one. So I was the eldest.
Yeah.
So I was discovering it. So Python, I didn't really get into until later. I loved the goodies. I was more the goodies.
Which is slapstick.
Than Python, yeah. Right.
What about Morecambe and Wise?
Oh, yeah. Of course. Yeah. I mean, the problem when you ask a question like that is I list a few people, yeah. And then the inference of my not mentioning Morecambe and Wise, I just can't.
Hated.
Well, of course. Yeah. I mean, Morecambe and Wise, I mean, wow, incredible. Yeah.
Well, shall we move to the working world of Sir Robert Brydon?
Yes.
And look at the sort of work method
that surrounds
partly Gavin and Stacey and partly the trip.
Okay.
So starting with, I would say, let's start with the trip, actually, because that's something you sort of manufacture yourself.
To a degree. Yeah. I mean, I think we have said that, but it does do something of a disservice to Michael Winterbottom, who was the director and creator. And, you know, I think Michael you know, does far more than he gets credit for. I mean, Michael decides everything. Where are we going to go? Which country? Which restaurants? Which literary figures we are in the shadow of as we do it?
Yeah.
And there's the plot and the structure, such as it is, of things that are happening. And, you know, scene by scene, what we might talk about. However, the bits that people quote and that they really love, they tend to be the improvisations.
Right. So that's the accident on the day, almost.
Sometimes Michael will have suggested it, but if I think of most of the ones that are most well known, they would almost all be stuff that just comes up. But then we finesse it, so it'll happen, and then... 'cause what happens with the trip, especially at the meals...
Yeah, do give us as much detail as you like, because this is really interesting.
All right, yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, for the meals, we usually spend, I think I'm right saying we spend a whole day on a meal. And we will eat each course three times. So we'll start with the starter. So we'll go, oh, yes, that's, thank you very much, yes. Funny talk. Eat, you know, eating with our mouths open out of necessity.
Yeah.
And we'll do that. Okay, cut. Okay, they'll take that away. So then we'll go, okay, that was quite a good bit there, wasn't it? Yeah, we didn't really get such and such. Michael might move the camera at that point. Let's go again. So they bring it in.
Great.
Second time, off we go again. And we might try to re-examine a seam that we hit. And cut at the end of that. Take it away. Okay, set the table up again. Okay, around this time, maybe he will move the camera now, but we'll go, yeah, that was the thing. Oh, we haven't mentioned such, yeah. And action, off we go. Oh, cut. Right, that's the starter done.
Can I pause there? Can I pause there and just say, how do you retain the spontaneity that you bring to that first take when you're in that third iteration? Do you find you have to concentrate on that, or do you find it actually quite easy and natural?
You do have to concentrate, Alex, and is that something you've ever considered?
That's good.
Well, that's the job, isn't it? That's being a performer, being an actor, is you know, that's the job.
That's the job, yeah. Okay,
but isn't there something that happens in the sort of physiology of us when something's for the first, when you're told a joke the first time, and the joke first comes out, and you respond in a way, and there's a sort of energy that's very, it's quite hard to reproduce that take.
I would refer you to my earlier answer. That's the job. That's what we get paid for. But it is, though.
Yeah,
I mean, absolutely. Well, the first time you do it, it's joyous. And wouldn't life be nice if that's all you had to do?
Yeah.
But you've got to... You've got to.
So that is actually... That's
like when someone says, oh, my mate Dave, he's funny. He's funny. He cracks us up in a pub. And I'll bet Dave is funny. I'll bet he's as funny as many professionals. But can he do it in Scarborough on a wet Tuesday in February when he's just had some devastating personal news? Good luck, Dave.
We've done the starter, the main course, and the dessert. That follows a similar pattern.
So I would go further than that, Alex. I would say an identical pattern.
So you get three stabs at each course.
Yes.
Michael Winterbottom will then harvest the bits that have...
And in fact, we've had a few experiences where we have gone back and reshot a whole meal because he wasn't happy with it. He didn't think it was good enough.
Right. Presumably, the repeat of that is allowing, if there is counted an absolute gem of a moment, he can take it from an earlier take.
Oh, yes, he can. Yes, of course. He can mix and match. And I dare say, if you were to watch it back, you might notice some glaring continuity as with the amount of food we've got.
Because we were chatting about the thick of it, and which is, it's almost actually Bill Sneddon's view of it was that we are trying to create the look of improvised, even though it's very carefully crafted. Right. But there's a sort of audience appreciation of something that looks like it's a magic that's just happened, which is exactly what you're doing on the trip, isn't it? It's as if the two of you just sat once, you did this for half an hour, and it was just gold.
Oh, yeah, well, yes.
Sorry.
A lot of people, a lot of people, I think, are under the impression that Michael is simply following us round as we go. I think that they are not aware of the level of construction and performance, because I've had people say to me, and I get a little bit sniffy when they say, yeah, I love that, I do like that eating one you do, yeah, because I like all of those, that one with Gino De Campo and you know, Gordon Ramsay. I go, yeah, it's not really the same thing, is it?
It is a revelation to me that you do three takes or three passes on each course, because it does come across as if Michael has just let a camera run while you and Steve have some fodder.
So again, I would refer you to my answer, which is that's the job.
Yeah. And how does that then, that segues into the world of Gavin and Stacey, which is an entirely different process, I presume. Mm-hmm. What is can you give us a day in the life of Rob Brydon on the Gavin and Stacey experience in terms of the day on set as an actor? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's very traditional. So it's wonderful. So you wake up at your hotel, marvelous.
Breakfast.
Of course,
always.
Well, depending on what time you're waking up. If you're waking up at the crack of dawn, you probably wait until you got to set. So you go downstairs. You may have had a little look at the call sheet to see who else is going to be on the bus with you, the van, whatever it is they sent. People carrier, you know. Oh, there's Matt. He's there. Hiya, morning. You know, in you get. Who are we waiting for? Right. So we're all on the bus.
So it's a bus job. You're not individual cars.
No, we would get on a people carrier. Okay. Yeah, it's great. Yeah. Well, it's a very happy show. Nobody's fussing. Anna, I don't think it's ever been. You may get cars for some aspects of it, but taking you from the hotel to unit base, it's almost always a people carrier.
Yeah.
Anyway, off you go. And you get out of the car. I mean, is this too much detail?
It's great. Carry on, because I think we're going to get to something useful.
to set, and we when we're in this Trinity Street, one of the other houses is used as a sort of green room area. So we go in there, we sit around, we all chatty chat chat, and off we go. And then when it's time to start filming, you'll go in, and let's say in the special, my first scene on screen was at the car with Gwen, and I'm saying, pull it taut, Gwen, pull it taut. So now, we had rehearsal for that show here in London. So we'd rehearsed this scene and had an idea of what we want, when I would come around the back of the car and when I would look up, all this kind of stuff. So we just refigure that in our minds. Oh, yeah, we said we'd do this, that's right. And then you start doing it and you find any practical challenges, you know. I mean, how are these bungee cords arranged over the roof rack and all that kind of stuff? Oh, I thought it was going to be more like this. And off you go. And then what happens is you do a little rehearsal with Chris, our director, Chris Gernon, and then they do what they call a crew show. Show it to the crew, and all the heads of departments all come round.
Oh.
Lighting, sound, makeup, wardrobe, art department, to see what is about to be shot and to see any issues that are going to arise. So we perform it for them, and then that finishes, and then we go off to the green room, and then they will light it and they will get it all ready. And then we'll get called back. So you're sitting around again. And then we get called back. Okay, let's do it. And then we do it. And then maybe they'll move the lights to have another angle. And so it goes for the day.
How many takes would you do? On the thick of it, there is we will shoot the script. Mm-hmm. And then there's improvised versions.
There's none of that.
Do you get, so there's no improvisation?
No, on Gavin and Stacey, it is 100% scripted. I was in a taxi the other day and the guy was saying to me, he said, oh yeah, I love the show. He said, that special at Christmas, so good. He said, how does it work? I imagine you can all just sort of throw in what you want if you think of something. I said, no. I said, it's a compliment that you think that, because I would imagine that suggests looks very spontaneous. No, the scripts are so good. I don't think anyone's ever thrown something in.
Really?
Mm.
Interesting.
It's supremely well written. And I think that with this special, reading the coverage afterwards, I think that that was sort of highlighted maybe for the first time, because in all these years of it being a huge show, I've not seen much stuff that bangs on about how good James and Ruth's scripts are. But this time I have noticed that.
Right. And did you participate at all in the writing process?
How how much clearer can I make this? It is written by Ruth Jones and James Corden. It's not some free-for-all like, what was it, The Thick of It, The Thick of Us. All right? It's not like that, okay? It is, they write the script, we act the script. Why can't you get that into your head?
Okay.
Yes, but I mean, to a degree, though. I mean, if you, no. They write it, we act it.
I've been told.
You have written some material yourself.
So yes.
So does that change the process for how you perform if you've been in the craft?
Well, if you've written it yourself, of course, you have more license to then change it. So most of the stuff I've written, with the exception of my live acts, TV stuff, I've written with other people. So Hugo Blick, Marion and Jeff, Julia Davis.
God bless her.
For Human Remains. Mm-hmm. Those are the notable ones, you know. So when you then it's different.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of improvisation in Marion and Jeff on the day. Human Remains, the scripts came about through improvisation, but then they were, I think if you were to look at those scripts, they would be pretty much what ended up on screen with some leeway. But they came through improvisation, because people, sometimes when they talk about that show, they're, oh, that was improvised. No, the writing, we would record hours of us talking in character, and then we'd send it away and have it transcribed. Mm. And sometimes when it would come back, the transcriber, lovely lady called Jaquetta, would have misheard something, but we would keep it in. So there was one episode called Slytherin, where we play a couple of Brummy swingers, and you know, people say, and the line was, people say that, you know, swinging it's just jerking off over other men's wives, but she heard it as junking off. So we kept that in. So in the show, he says, you know, just junking off over other men's wives, but there's more than that. And then there's a pause, and he says, because there's more than that. There's travel.
So in that writing process, that's very interesting to hear. You had a transcriber who took the bulk of your material.
Yeah, we would send off these tapes. And they were tapes, you know, nowadays it'd be a file, but they were literally, what were they on?
Cassette.
Either cassettes or small cassettes.
Hi-8 tapes.
Or they might even have been mini disc. I can't remember. No, it wasn't Hi-8. No, it would have been those little cassettes, like dictaphone.
DV. Maybe DV tapes.
No, it was DV. That's right.
DV tapes.
It was, because we also filmed all these things. You can see these on YouTube, these sessions. And that's what we would do. And then we would get pages back, and you'd go through it. We'd each go through it and highlight what we thought. And what we found was that in the improvisation, all sorts of stories would suggest themselves and plot points. That same episode, you know, I mean, your sister's, we just said this out of nowhere, your sister's been with us now how long? Oh, it must be 3 years, 3 years. But she doesn't make a fuss. No, we don't get a peep out of her. I mean, that's the beauty of a coma. And there's like, so that just happened. So from that, well, all right, so we've got a sister that lives with us and she's in a coma. Oh, okay. And it grows then, and things just suggest themselves, which I don't think I mean, maybe Julia could, but I couldn't certainly think of that just sat there typing.
And where do you do that? Is it in the kitchen?
We did it in all sorts of places. So, and when you watch, if you watch those writing sessions, they were on the DVD and they're on YouTube. There's some at the top room of a house I was living in. Mostly it's at Julia's. It's at Julia's flat that no longer exists, that was in the same building that Kenneth Williams had lived in.
Oh, great.
Have I not told you that? And as you went up in the lift to Julia's floor, you would go past the floor that Kenneth had lived on. And it was always a buzz, you know, to go up there and think, wow, Kenneth Williams, you know, oh, around the belt. Oh, and he'd be coming up, you see, like that. Oh, how nice to come. How nice to Valdi or eat.
Dolly Oldie.
Dolly Oldie, yeah. So that was a thrill, yeah.
So that's very, so you would manufacture that in Julia's flat, basically, mm-hmm. over the course of a day, and mm-hmm. though that material would be then transcribed,
yes.
you'd get those transcripts back.
And I think we would look at them separately. Julia would tell you she did the bulk of the work, and I think that's probably probably true. She was
editor.
Yeah, but Julia's quite, you know, not obsessive, that's a horrible word, but she's like...
And oh, she has a jeweler's eyepiece.
Yeah, but also there'd be reams of paper. And I would get, I'd be overwhelmed by, I can't deal, you know. I'll tell you a great example. When we're writing together, and it says a lot about our personalities, is it, let's say we're constructing something with two characters. They do this, they do this, they do this. Then she would suggest something in conflict with what was already established. And I go, oh, but no. But it was 9 times out of 10 a great idea, because it would introduce conflict into the story, and you need conflict. Whereas I would sort of be happier with more of a general character study with micro conflicts within what they're saying. So they may be contradicting themselves or little comic things, but she would have more of a thing where this is not a real one, but we blah, da, 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 and then she might say, and then so-and-so breaks their leg. And I would go, break their leg, but oh, that's going to change it. Does that make sense to you?
It's a perfect combination. If you, as you've just said that lovely phrase there, you like the character study, whereas she brings more of the sort of firework to it.
But she's as much the character study as I am. I mean, that's not to, but she also had, because of course she's written her own stuff tons since we did that, but she also... I might be more like that now. I think I might have learned that it's all well and good creating these interesting characters, but you need conflict. Now, James Corden told me a really interesting thing when we were doing this last special, and I'm going to misquote him when it comes to writing. He said, if there are three people in the scene, one person should not know something that the other two know. Right. Or two people should not know something. You know, there should be some little tension. Conflict and tension all the time. And I think that bears out if you watch, maybe you watch the special. I think you got, now in this scene, Bryn doesn't know that such and such and such. So, for example, when Bryn and Gwen are putting the thing on the roof of the car, and then they have the conversation, Bryn and Stacey don't know that Gwen is seeing Dave Coaches. There's a great example.
Right.
Or the audience don't know, right? That, so when Smithy is at John Lewis doing the wedding list, the audience is the one that doesn't know that it's going to be Sonia, not Nessa, that is revealed. And that's a great note. That's a great piece of advice for writing.
That's a really useful piece of yeah, absolutely.
I think you should bear it in mind, certainly.
I'd love to unpack a bit because I think get you what you do brilliantly right. You've got a actor, Rob Ryden,
who shows
up and performs scripts.
Yes.
And you're just naturally funny. And there's obviously skills and things that you do that. We could try and understand that more. And the other is the kind of writing, creating, or sorry, so more presenter
mm-hmm.
on the, nothing scripted, mm-hmm. turn up, Rob.
Yes.
And if I'm sensing your passion with like Barry's approach, it's more you just turning up and being.
You just turn up, and you just be, and this is where we could get into Sued's corner on Private Eye, or it could sound a little pretentious. You are, I mean, I'll be 60 this year, and I went straight into this sort of work from drama school. You know, I left early to go and work on the radio. So I've been doing this in one form or another, whether it's radio presenting, television presenting, I mean, shopping channel presenting, you know, all sorts of stuff for a long time. So when you go in and you are just rocking up and you're just you, you're doing it now with so much experience. And that's in the form of a sort of a database of lines, but also just attitudes and angles, but also a database of technique and strategy that you've learned from that terrible gig you did at Alexandra Palace at 4 o'clock in the afternoon for 700 insurance salesmen. Seriously. But also from that great gig you did at the wherever in front of your adoring fans. You learned stuff there. So all that stuff, I mean, you know, you talk about turning up and just being great. When I was starting out, I would turn up. And when I was still in Wales, a friend of mine was producing a show called the BBC Good Diet Programme or Good Health Programme or something. It was made by BBC Wales, but I think it went out on the network. And all these people were trying to lose weight. And I was employed as the warm-up man. And I thought it'd be a funny idea, because I didn't really have any material, to give somebody who was going in the queue for the studio, the audience, I gave this woman a Mars bar. And I said, look, if you put that in your handbag, and then I'll do a thing later, it'll be funny, right? Because I was gonna do, I said, a sub Robin Williams. Someone is not telling the truth. I will find out who it is. So I come out, they're all sat down, they all come in, and I go, well, welcome along, and I start doing this. Wait a minute, I say, have you all been trying to lose weight? Yeah. There's a non-believer. But I've forgotten what the woman looks like. And I can't find her. And I'm looking, and I'm going up and down, and she isn't. She's, wow, like most members of the bodyguard, she's now very shy. She's not going to offer up. And as I'm dying doing this, some droll fellow in the front goes, we've come to lose weight, not a bloody pantomime. So fuck those experiences.
Yeah,
I think you have to go through and you learn from them. So were I to do that again, I probably wouldn't. But if I were to do something similar, I would be damn sure I remembered what she looked like. I would find a way of making a mental picture of her in my head.
But I think it's also very comforting for people who are listening who might be sort of beginning their journey as a creative to realise that the failures are just as valuable as the successes.
So much. You know, if I were to give advice, I would say stage time or screen time. Just get that stage time and learn and be open and listen and watch and gather as much knowledge and as much experience as you can.
To create a database, as you say, of experience.
And when you have the terrible, crushing ones, take it from me, you've just had a fantastically valuable experience because you're going to learn so much from that.
That's great. Mm. I've got two questions I want to ask, just quick fires. Yeah. We've got them.
Yeah.
Number one, what have you stolen from a fellow performer in your travels? Just one item that you've stolen from another that you would like to pass on or that you use?
Well, interestingly, it slightly comes back to what I was saying about Julia. And now with her, it's in the script, creation of the script. She was always aware of the advantage of having some conflict in the script, and she would never get too stuck in. Now, equally, another, you know, these are all great talents, obviously. Steve Coogan, when we've done the trip, it's taken me quite a while, because I'm quite a friendly person, and I like jump back and forth. He is very comfortable with conflict. So when we are rehearsing something, sometimes we've sort of come to blows because he's been, And I go, well, why are you being, you know? But now I think I am more open to a bit of back and forth, a little bit of rough and tumble for the good of what it is you're trying to achieve. So I might, just a little bit, not as much as him, but I'm more open to that.
To combat.
To it doesn't have to be. You can. Yeah.
You could disagree. You could almost be in a different zone.
Yes.
He's up for you to have a bit of an argument.
That's a great way. You can disagree. You can fight your corner to the point where you go, oh, that's not very nice. But it's fine. And you'll get something better.
Whereas two people that love each other is just a bit...
And yet, having said that, of course, I've done plenty of terrific stuff where we have... It depends on the person. I think that's very much his way. Yeah. Julia and I didn't used to... You know, we would very much just yes and, yes and, yes and. Sometimes she'd say yes and, like I say, it breaks his leg, but that's going to make things tricky because now well, you have a wheelchair. Well, yeah, no, it was all nice as it was, right? But then, you know, that's actually really good.
Yeah,
yes.
And if I tell you what, I watch some shows now. I watch shows. So we've been watching stuff like, you know, particularly the earlier seasons of Slow Horses, which is great, really well written, or you know, Breaking Bad, or these terrific shows. And if you just scientifically watch them, so they've established this. Oh, now they've done this. Ah. I almost think of it just as, oh, that's a lot of work for the writers. Now they're going to think this way. And that's a terrible way to think about it.
But it's, I mean, some of these great American shows that have multiple writers.
Well,
they can create a sort of a massive drop every episode.
Well, I was with Stephen Merchant the other day, and my son was telling him, we've really got into the American Office. And Steve directed some of those and was an exec on them, of course. And my son was telling him about this particular episode that he really liked. And it turns out Steve had directed it. Oh, wow, there's no chances of that. And we talked about that episode. And he said at one point, they had this already. And then Steve said to them, yeah, well, what about this? I was some personal experience of his. He said, so I went down to the writer's room, you know, and said, you should have this. And then next thing you know, they've got the scene.
Looking back over the last 40 years of your experience, your writing and your performing, can you identify what you might describe as the DNA of what makes something funny?
Is it so subjective? Because as we know, to our cost, people say it's not funny, you know. Even Gavin Stacey, which has broken all the records ever known to man, you know, you can snoop around online, you'll find people who think it's
not so good.
Nothing that think is terrible, you know. So it's subjective. For me, gosh, I don't know. I mean, you're sort of asking for a great pronouncement here, but there's going to be some surprise in it. There's, you know, it's good. If you want to be very simplistic, you take somebody one way and then you surprise them. There's going to be some recognition of truth, some level.
Well, they're two perfect pieces of DNA. Perhaps just putting it into the context of Gavin and Stacey, on each scene that you did, as you reflect, can you walk away from those scenes and go, oh, yeah, that's what was funny about it.
Oh, that's a good question. Well, let's think of a specific scene. Well, if you think about the barn dance scene from the second series, where we sing Islands in the Stream, it's a surprise party for Gwen. So the components there would be, from my perspective, Bryn, this rather nervy character, is planning a secret party. So you've got tension. You've got, I know something Gwen doesn't know about. The audience knows it. I know it. Everybody knows it, actually. But Gwen doesn't know it. So that falls into James's theory. You get the opportunity for my character, Bryn, to play some heightened emotions. So when Ted comes to the door, he can go, he's playing all this, you know. So we're seeing the character we love under pressure. Then we get to the barn dance itself, and I'm even more stressed now because Gwen could arrive at any minute. We got all our regular characters, but they're looking different. They're dressed for a line dancing evening. We've got the other stuff going on about Jean, who's a character that Gwen doesn't like. Is Jean coming? So that, again, that's somebody knows something, somebody doesn't. Then you get... You get just funny character lines. So when Pam and Mick arrive, they say, look at you, Bryn. And Bryn says, I know, I'm wearing a pair of denim jeans. And that's funny because in his world, he would add the word denim to them, right? And so that tells you something about him. Then when Gwen does arrive and he jumps out and he goes, surprise, surprise. Well, the comedy in that is this ludicrous letting off of steam from Bryn, who has been so worked up. And it's funny to see him doing that. Sometimes it's what's funny for one person wouldn't be funny for another. So when I'm on stage, I can get a lot of laughs if I suddenly turn on somebody, which takes us back to Barry Humphries when he would insult somebody. Because generally, I'm all smiley. So my audience seems to like it if I become cross, as they do when Bryn does it. So there's all those things.
That's really interesting. And a great vignette, actually, as to how comedy works and what makes it, yeah, it, what makes it...
Well, I think with those things, you only have your own observations and you know, and it's so subjective, which is why, of course, when someone says so-and-so's not funny, I always raise my eyebrows, because you might as well say avocados don't taste good.
Yeah.
You don't like avocados.
Is there a clip or a sketch or a moment in film or television or on stage which you remember as is the most you've ever laughed? Is there something that where you just can't? Because I actually, to be honest, I remember your good friend Steve Coogan when he did one of his first live shows.
Yes.
I loved Alan Partridge, but I went to go and see him. And actually my respect for his performance was surpassed because his timing was so immaculate. His craft on stage. I mean, yeah,
really?
But you know, it was, and I just remember there was a point where in the second half I couldn't breathe.
Some of the times I laugh the most, I would say, is when I'm with Lee Mack. You know, if I'm just in a social thing with Lee, because we'll sometimes see each other and go for a dog walk or have lunch or dinner with our wives. And he can make me laugh, particularly when he's making fun of me. I can find that very, very funny. This is one of those questions where in an hour's time I'll go, but you didn't say, I watched that Alan Bennett documentary that was on over Christmas called Alan Bennett at 90, I think. And there were a lot of clips of his work. Uh-huh. And the laughs I was giving that were just the spontaneous act of laughter. But it was also a bloody hell, that's so clever. Bloody hell, that's such a great observation. Bloody hell, that's so well constructed. So my laugh was a sort of, like that, you know?
Delight.
So we were all there watching it, that's right. And I remember now, and I'd be sat there and I'd go, like that, you know? As opposed to then the stuff, if I'm hanging out with Lee, it might be, I'm almost crying with laughter because it's sort of relentless. So there's, different types.
And it's harder as a practitioner of brilliant comedy as you are, it's quite hard to just be a person enjoying this. Because you can't detach yourself from going, how's that being done? At one level, you're analysing it as well.
One final question, if I may, then, before we must. comedy and cruelty.
Yes.
Does comedy need to be unkind, offend, rude, naughty, disgraceful? And does that need to be preserved? Does that...
It doesn't need to be that, but it should be allowed to be that, because that's part of it. Yes. It does need to be preserved. Of course it does, because it's a pressure valve. I always, you know, comedy's a pressure valve. I really do believe that. I think you can laugh at somebody or something without cruelty, because so many of those laughs, I believe, are saying we're all human, aren't we?
Perfection. We can end on that.
That's a lovely
question. Great. Sir Bernard, I owe you big time. That was such a pleasure and so kind of you.
Tremendous. Absolutely tremendous. Yeah.
I mean, I'm a very good guest. There's no getting away from it, is there?